Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Hello and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I'm a writer, actor, and comedian. And our guest today is Lauren Badillo Milisi, who is a Jersey-born, Florida-raised poet and entertainment writer based in Brooklyn. She's the author of Sad Sexy Catholic from Clash Books. It's my favorite title of a book ever. Thank you for coming on.
No, thank you for having me.
Today's book is from 1979, written by V.C. Andrews, Flowers in the Attic. This book, I feel like I didn't really know a lot about. I knew it was like dark. And yet anyone who has any interaction with it or the movie like gasps when it is mentioned or has some very large reaction. It feels like just like a looming pop culture presence. So I'm so excited that you wanted to do this and so excited. I mean, just before we started recording, you had a big stack of physical books, quite the expert. So I'm so excited to get into this. I want to do a little bit of context, and the pod is creeping on episode 100. So I've decided to retool my history section just a little bit. We're going to do bad stuff that happened, good stuff. So some bad stuff, Three Mile Island, nuclear meltdown, Unabomber sets off his second and third bombs. Good stuff, Nickelodeon debuts, LA passes the gay and lesbian civil rights bill, and we get the first Happy Meal.
Wow. Now I want a Happy Meal.
Yeah. The toys were a stencil, a wallet, an ID bracelet, a puzzle lock, a spinning top, or a McDonald Land character-shaped eraser.
That's more than they give us now.
I know. I was surprised at how many options there were. And then a little bit about V.C. Andrews. She's born Cleo Virginia Andrews in Portsmouth, Virginia. This book takes place in Virginia. She has a fall as a teenager that caused some severe back injuries, so she spends most of her life using crutches or a wheelchair. She's a successful commercial artist, illustrator, portrait painter, and supports, after her father dies in 1957 when she's in her 30s, she supports the family based on those art commissions. She writes her first novel, Gods of Green Mountain, which is not published until, I think, 04, when she's 49. And her first published novel is this, Flowers in the Attic, which comes out when she is 58. She wrote it in 2 weeks. And she publishes, I think, a new novel every single year until her death. She only dies 7 years later at 63 of breast cancer. But I have heard similar things about My Sweet Audrina, that these are not only cult classics, but classics. So what is your relationship to this book? How did it come into your life the first time?
I was friends with this. So it's, what's really funny is you'll talk to like a 70-year-old, like my dad, and he'll be like, you know what? In the sixth grade, like Bobby Rosenfeld and I were on the playground. And I'm like, how the fuck do you know that name? I could tell you the name of the girl who gave me the book. She was in eighth grade. I was in sixth grade. Her name was Stephanie Barron. And she was reading it. And she was like, this is so nasty and gross and weird. And like, oh my God, you should read it. And so I read it. And I was in after school care because my middle school started at 9:15 and ended at 4:15 for some fucking reason. So we were all in after school care because who's going to pick us up? And I remember the after school care, like teacher lady going, are you reading the book where the brother and sister have intercourse? Like, that is literally verbatim what she said. And I was like, yeah, I really like it. I'm 11.
But I do think that is how the book is known. I was trying to think of, like, what's the most succinct way you can describe this book? Four siblings are trapped in an attic. And then you can keep getting bigger. They're trapped in an attic because their mom is trying to get back in the good graces of her father so that she can be included in the will and he can't know about the kids. And it goes on and on and on.
Because the kids are a product of incest, technically.
Yes. And then there's more incest later on between the two older siblings, Kathy and Christopher. Did you read all of the books when you were young? Did you just devour it, fall into this world? You had some other, you had all the V.C. Andrews books, including outside of this series.
I don't know where Petals on the Wind is, but yes, because it gets worse as they go on. Like, a lot of people, I think, just stop with Flowers in the Attic because, like, you just can. But, like, they keep having babies and shit, like, and stuff gets real weird and, like, real bad. And then eventually Christopher and Kathy get married and, like, go under different names to, like, have their family together and stuff, while hiding from, like, the people who are still, I guess, alive that are part of the Foxworth family. And it just, it ends on, like, I wouldn't say, like, there's a singular happy fucking V.C. Andrews novel ending. I would say it ends on a fine, like, okay note. I really want everyone to fucking, like, read them. Like, if you're listening to this and you've never read the other ones, like, I please don't Wikipedia them. Just, like, just pick a weekend. They're really short reads, too. I think the longest one is probably, like, almost 400 pages, but every King book is 1,000 pages. So if you can get through a Stephen King book, you can do this. Yeah, she had a whole, I don't know if it was, like, a file cabinet full of every idea for every single book and every single character and everything. And then that's what they've been using this entire time to pump out all the books.
Yeah, because after she died, there was a ghostwriter who's something like Andrew Niemeyer. I don't have his name.
Andrew Niemeyer, who wrote The Devil and Daniel Webster.
Oh, I did find a quote by her that was something like, I don't want a single boring sentence in my work. I want this to be a page turner. And she succeeded. I did, as soon as I finished, because it sets up, like, the ending is so perfect for, you know, the kids get out of the attic and they say, like, we're going to have control over everything that happens in our life right now. So I did immediately go on to Libby, the app, and place a hold on Petals in the Wind. So it's coming to me. I'm going to get there. There are a lot of people who are also very excited to read this book.
My cover of that one is at home in Florida. That one has, like, the scariest. So it's funny because, like, so all of the books have these scary inserts, like the original ones. And so for Petals on the Wind, I'm pretty sure it's the one of the twins laying in her deathbed.
Wow.
Because that's what happens in the book. And, but I'm not gonna tell you which twin, but yeah, like, they all have this, like, us, like, and my edition of Sweet Audrina also has this. Yeah, they all have these, like, scary inserts. These are also the most expensive to thrift because of the scary inserts.
Right.
But yeah, if you can get your hands on the scary inserts, like, they're so great because they add to the overall mood of, like,
yes. I have the 40th anniversary, which does not have that, but it does have a foreword by Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl and Sharp Objects. And it's like a 3-page foreword that I really enjoyed. Who designed the cover? Oh, Milton Charles. And illustration by Jillian Hills. Because I was like, they are so distinct in their style. Even her other novels outside of the Dollinganger series, she has such a specific style, and in writing, she is this, like, cultural entity unto herself that is so astonishing. There was one thing in this foreword that I just wanted to highlight. She talks about Kathy. There are four siblings. The oldest is Christopher. They spend, like, 3 years in this attic. So Christopher going in is 15, Kathy is 12, and then their twins, Corey and Carrie, who are 5? And so Flynn says, the narrator Kathy, who ages from 12 to 15 over the course of the story, is part princess and part witch. She's tantrum prone, pessimistic, cynical. Basically, I adored her because she is like all girls around the age of 13. At turns sulky, giving, selfish, charming, nasty, and heroic. Which I sort of, in reading it, didn't really clock, I think, because I think all of her reactions, I was like, this makes sense. All of this makes sense based on the horrific things that they go through. But I think that is such an astute observation and such a reason why this book succeeds. It is a deeply real person in a deeply, not absurd, but heightened, unreal situation.
Yes. So what's like kind of terrifying about it is like the realism of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's the rumor that like she like heard the story from like a doctor when she was in the hospital. The reality really is that she was trapped by her mother her entire life.
Oh, I didn't know that.
She, in a very rare interview, and I wrote a poem about this in my forthcoming book, but she, to describe her life sitting in this fucking chair while her mom just kind of like is in control of her, basically. She goes, no, it's fine. I'm just like Rapunzel.
Mm.
And she's wearing her little white nightgown. And I just thought that was like one of like the saddest fucking things to, like, anyone could ever say. Because she wanted to be an actress. She wanted to, and then she like had like that fall. And they let her be in the movie, which is cool. There's a scene there's a scene in the 80s movie where she's like a maid or something in Foxworth Hall, which I thought was very cool. That movie was originally supposed to be directed by Wes Craven. Wow. The studio was like, absolutely not. What the fuck? It's not a horror book. Motherfucking yes, it is. And it would have been a much better, different movie. The Lifetime remake movie was fine. People liked it enough or they kept making more.
Right.
It was a good cast, I guess. I would love for someone to make a new horror take on it because like it deserves it.
It is horror. I was reading this at one point. I don't know if I like to annotate my books. And at one point I wrote something like, every page is stabbing me. It is so hard and dark and like a manual for how to slowly kill a person physically and emotionally. It's dang.
We also learned that you can't drink blood for nourishment.
Yeah, the detail is incredible in some of the horror, which is it's so sad. I didn't know that about Wes Craven, but it is literally horror. And I think that would have been incredible. But yeah, there's a point later on, the kids go through starvation a couple times. And at one point, Christopher, who wants to be a doctor, they have all of these books in this attic. And so he slices his wrist open for the twins to eat, because they are so malnourished. At one point, they talked about eating mice. And I think they do the blood thing instead of the mice or the rats. It is the detail that is so astonishing. There's even one moment where Kathy is just describing a dream. And it's very much a throwaway line. But she's like, yeah, and then grandmother, who traps them with their mom, grandmother cuts off my breasts and then just keeps talking. I mean, this book was banned in schools, which makes sense to me. I kind of don't understand how this is. Do you have any idea, you know, both for you sort of contemporarily and then in 79, in the 80s, how this was marketed?
So what's really funny is that it was marketed as horror. And the reason, so there's a part in Stephen King's On Writing where he talks about bestsellers that are bad. And he says Flowers in the Attic is like proof that anyone could write anything. I would love you to know that there was one year where Flowers in the Attic won a horror award over a King book. And so I truly believe that it's just fucking him being salty because like, come on. I'm sorry, but Flowers in the Attic is better than Cujo. Like, yeah. And I love King. I have a Stephen King rules like blanket over there, and I still like, come on. But it was marketed as horror, which I thought was really, really interesting. And also they marketed it as like a man, even though these are like the fucking girliest covers.
Yeah.
They very much marketed it as like a man is writing these like very ooh, like salacious books. So there was like, it was like horror, but it was just like sexy and like, ooh, like you've never read anything like this before. And then like throughout the years, it like just became, I feel like post 2000, it was just like, oh, the incest book. But back then it was like still taboo, but like it was more like, like the 80s were like the most sexual time for pop culture like ever. And so, and the 70s were like, as we're coming, we have the golden age of porn and everything. I feel like everything in pop culture is getting very sexualized before we start heading into that like weird, like now everything's reversed and the Gen Zers are like, when does things happen in movies?
Right.
Yeah, it was just kind of like, it wasn't as, according to like my mom and like other women I've spoken to, it was not as like, oh my God, this is the incest book. It was just kind of like, oh, hey, did you read that? It's scary, right?
Mm. So obviously, it is a book about teen years, about 12 to 18, what it means to grow up without parent figures. I think there's something very relatable in, it's heightened in this, but the process of your parents not only becoming people to you, but also being strangers to you through their mom, who is this loving, caring figure at the beginning, who says, we have to do this out of necessity, and her mother is really the bad one, the grandmother. And then you come to find out those roles kind of switch, and their mother is the coldest, most calculating, horrible person. But I wonder why this is such a... Well, first off, I did not know that people thought it was a man, although that makes sense because it's V.C. Andrews, you know, J.K. Rowling, we know all of that. And yet that is so creepy to me because this is about this, I mean, a lot of things, but it's so specifically set in a young girl's perspective. It is Kathy writing in first person, and it is about a young girl's sexuality. Like, to me, it would be gross if a man had written this.
Which is really interesting, right? Like, it just doesn't, like, man. Yeah, I just like flipped to like the last page because like I forgot how like awful this is. Man. And like the note to readers in the book, I think also tells you like just a little bit. This was after her death that this admission came out, but it doesn't talk about like, this is almost like every note to readers in all of like the editions. Like they just talk about like her, like dreams coming true and books opening up doors and shit. Like they don't say anything about the actual, like, because I feel like it was just so much more normalized, I guess.
Yeah. In my book, there's a book club reading guide with, you know, questions and topics for discussion. And I know those are not always in, you know, high school level books, but to me, it feels like a high school sort of thing. Yeah, it swiftly became a rite of passage for teenage girls, which I guess is the whole thing about childhood and that I see in a lot of the books we cover on this, is that, like, as a kid, you understand that there is forbidden knowledge. There are things that you don't know. And I think in this, not only are the kids forbidden knowledge, all of this hangs on the fact that this grandfather does not know that they were ever born, but also there is so much forbidden and unknown and purposefully kept from them. And because they are so trapped, there is so much that they don't know just about puberty, about growing up, that they learn when they eventually get a TV. They learn so much about life from that TV.
There's a part where she like writes in chalk. What is it? Like, we lived in the attic.
Yeah, it's like, as they leave. It's obviously not this, but it's sort of like, Kathy was here. And the longer they are in the attic, they struggle with this thing of like, are we even real?
Yeah.
Now that we've been up here. And so that it's Kathy's way of saying like, we are here. We were here.
Wait, let's see if I can do this. Hold on.
Yes.
We lived in the attic. Christopher, Corey, Carrie, and me. Now there are only three.
Correct. Yeah, that's I think in the
that always bothered me for some reason as a kid.
How so?
It just was so sad. There's something like the second book. I don't want to like spoil. It's been out since the dawn of time, Lauren, like over 50 years. But the way they end up going about like their revenge and stuff, and how they don't feel satisfied after, has also always bothered me too. Because I'm like, I would feel satisfied. Like, what the fuck? I should not have been 12 going like, bitch, like, why aren't you stabbing her? Like, what? But I remember just like, also the illustrations, like at least the original. So they changed it to be less scary.
Right.
I thought was interesting. So it's a different cover artist. But it really set the tone. So when I was reading the book, all I saw was like the pale, pale skin and the red, red eyes that they really just kind of, because like I read some analysis on it, but they were like, they're all supposed to look like rats basically, or like have like the feel of that. Because what's in an attic?
Yeah. However, speaking of rodents, I never read either, but vaguely knowing about these books, I always got Flowers in the Attic and Flowers for Algernon confused, which is a book about a mouse that dies, who's medical testing. So maybe we should do that. Oh, but I did want to mention, this episode is going to come out the day before Thanksgiving, and that feels right.
That does feel correct, yes. Gather around your family. That does feel correct, yes.
Yeah. I guess the next thing I wanted to talk about is, so much of this book is about, there's so much plot in here, that Kathy and Chris and Corey and Carrie's parents, Corinne and, what even was his, her, was it also Christopher, their father?
What was the father's name? Because the grandmother is Olivia.
their father dies. That's the in a car crash. That's the inciting incident. But mom and father, he was her first uncle. Her grandfather was his father. And so her parents hate that they got together, cast her out of the family. She's has these four kids, and then he dies. And in order to get back in his good graces, because there's a lot of religion, which I also want to talk about. But in putting these children in the attic, which the grandmother is also a big part of, and we think it's all her, and then we find out later mom is perpetuating it. There is so much religious zeal. The grandmother is so convinced that Chris and Kathy will become incestuous because their parents were, that the act of it, of putting it in their minds and of making it so that they are the only people the other one is around, especially while they're in puberty, makes it this self-fulfilling prophecy that they become exactly what they were told not to be, even though at the beginning they're like, there's no way we're ever going to do that. Of course not. And I guess I just wanted to talk about that as a concept.
That scene is awful because directly after Christopher goes, sorry, I kind of raped you, Kathy.
Yeah. Yes. And like, Kathy's like, no.
Then she goes, and now there might be a baby.
Immediately. Yeah. Yeah. Which I guess is like when the last 3 years of your life have been about being the product of incest, I guess it's not a crazy thing for your mind to immediately go to.
In both movies, it is portrayed as like completely consensual, like fun, good times. I'm pretty sure the Lifetime, actually, you know what? The Lifetime movie, you know, it's Lifetime, so I might be remembering it wrong because, again, it's Lifetime. And they love a good implied assault scene in every fucking Lifetime movie.
He basically, I'm trying to find the exact page, but he kind of goes like rabid. He's aggressive. He's chasing her around the room.
Oh yeah. It's also consensual in a Lifetime movie, which I think is like, I think it's really interesting that like, even in 2022, they were like, we don't want to show that like, this is bad. And I'm like, you know what? Kudos to you guys for trying to like make the incense feel okay. Like I appreciate that actually. I don't know. I just thought that was interesting. It was like, you know, we can deal with the incest, but it can't be violent.
Especially because, I mean, I have no academic knowledge of this at all. I feel like most incest is violent. I feel like that is the most common version of this.
We all saw the band X-Files episode Home.
With Mama under the bed. Yeah.
Which is a real fucking, based on a true story. I wish I got to interview Gillian Anderson for like not Tron Aries, but anyway. Wait, what chapter is the?
It's wrong. It's in My Stepfather, I think. Yeah, he appeared wild and furious enough to slap my face. He shook me until my eyes rolled. Primitive, savage. And then there's, I think like 2 pages later at the end of that chapter, she says, I knew that through me, he had struck back at the one woman who had betrayed him in trust, faith, and love, meaning their mother. Mm-hmm. That was so interesting to me because the dynamic is constantly Kathy saying, like, our mom is doing this to us. It's not just the grandmother perpetuating this abuse on us. And Christopher, I mean, starts off saying, no, 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 she's a good woman. She has to do this. And then gets to the point of like, Kathy, I cannot accept the reality of our mother being a bad person. Not in so many words, but yeah.
Man, I forgot how much this page sucks.
Yeah. Even then, after it happens, now I had all the answers. Now there might be a baby.
The thing is, like, he's right, unfortunately, when he says, like, no matter what comes into your future, you'll always belong to me, because that's kind of how it plays out for, like, the rest of it. Because one thing is, like, you can't come back from that.
No.
And Kathy does end up getting with this other dude. And then he ends up being, like, the worst fucking man alive. Mm-hmm. And then I think that, like, they have a baby, he dies. Fuck, I'm trying to remember, like, the image. There's, like, and then they live under, like, assumed names in Florida, of all places. And you know what? Florida is a great place to hide. I grew up there. I feel like even if, like, that didn't happen, like, the incest didn't happen, they still, their lives were doomed from kind
of. Yeah. How do you go through that and not cling to each other forever? Even if there never was a sexual relationship, these three people are going to be eternally bonded because no one else in the world will ever understand that.
Recently, I met someone who might be the only person on planet Earth who would be super fine. I'm empathetic to that. who would be like, you know what, I understand and I hope they're okay. Like I finally met like someone who
to the incest part?
To just all the all of it.
To the four kids. Because one thing we haven't touched on is that one of the twins dies. Corey, yes. The boy twin, dies.
The donuts laced with arsenic.
Yes, because the grandmother will bring up like all of their meals for the day in the morning. There's lots of technical stuff about like when she can come up because the servants will see, because this is a gigantic house. So she brings up all the meals at once, and then there's always these like little powdered donuts in them. Mm-hmm. And very late on, we find out that grandma has not been putting the powdered donuts there. Mom has, and the powder is arsenic. Mm-hmm. And Corey eats the most donuts, and Kathy gives him hers because he's sad. And so Corey has arsenic poisoning, and then I think like gets the flu or gets pneumonia or something, and he dies. The last minute, they beg their mother, please take him to the hospital, and he dies at the hospital. I mean, that's what we're told. That's the thing that even, ugh.
And then Carrie becomes a ballerina. Like, she gets older, she becomes a ballerina, and then she dies in the second book.
Wow. She becomes a ballerina just like Kathy always wanted to be a ballerina. Yeah. Fascinating. Yes.
Uh-huh. And like, or at least like she was taking dance class, but like they were all still miserable, like trying to move through everything, which was like obviously. We can talk about like one of the revenge scenes like later on in the episode, but because it bothers me. The reveal that we get at the end of the book, it still makes me angry. And it's written in such a way. She was like, oh, by the way, actually, guess what? It's not actually what we thought it was. And then it's just kind of like, they went through all of that and that's the, okay.
Yes, with the grandfather?
Yes.
Yes. So they spend all of this time, mom saying, grandpa's going to die any second, and then you guys can get out. At first, they go up there, and like, it's going to be a night. It's going to be like a week, and then, of course, it gets longer and longer. With side note, grandfather is 67 years old, and they act like he is 110. But then we get at the end, it has been 3 years. Christopher has been sneaking out of the attic trying to collect money so that they have something. They have money for when they escape. And they get down there and realize grandfather has been dead for a long ass time. They see him early on at like a Christmas party, which I also, I want to come back to the Christmas party with how the grandmother is presented in that scene. But that is such a devastating thing because they also sort of come one after the other of like, mom has been poisoning the donuts. Grandfather is not here. Grandmother is in that same sequence. We see she is praying. She is asking for forgiveness for what has been done to the children. We find out that's mostly mom's hand in that. It's so much.
And then Corinne gets married.
Yes, Corinne gets married to a younger man. And there's such a great line in that when Kathy sort of finally has her reckoning with mom and says, how on earth is he still gonna love you when he finds out you've had four kids trapped in an attic for years?
Yep. My dad just texted me, like, are you alive? Like, what do I even say? Yes. I'm not, like, okay. Speaking of present parents who aren't existing, like, you know, it's like I forget what happens to Bert in the second book as things go on, but like, yeah, the revelation that the mother is evil is fucking insane, man. And I mean, not super insane, but I think when you're 11 reading this, like, you still, I have this like idea that adults are supposed to be good. And I think that's why I think every child should read Stephen King, because in almost every King book, if the children are correct and no one fucking listens to them.
Yeah.
The Welcome to Derry series that's on right now is very much that. And it is fucking frustrating as shit. I want to kill everybody in cold blood. But this was one of those books where I was just like, oh yeah, adults are bad sometimes.
It is an important thing. Like, even if you as a child have not experienced a parent or an adult behaving badly, it is important to know that that is a thing that happens. And that anyone is capable of malice, I think, is instructive. And then I think also, like, if you have experienced that, it's validating. And over the course of this podcast, not being believed or the fear of not being believed is very recurs a lot in a lot of these books and the ones that stay with people.
My sweet Audrina. Oh, there's a bookmark in here. Hello. Oh, I love when that happens. Okay, that's cool. I love when there's little relics of the past.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay, look at this creepy shit.
Thanks. Oh my gosh.
In her case, it's because Sweet Adriana is a standalone book, but then, of course, they decided to, like, as the years went on with the ghostwriter, to, like, make a bunch of sequels. And then Lifetime, I think, ended up making those movies as well, even though we didn't need any. Every adult in this book fails the shit out of her. And I really do think that comes not just from, like, whatever pop culture, like, our girl was consuming at the time while she was kind of trapped in her chair painting, but, like, also just, again, from her own, like, mother. So that is what I believe. And that is what a lot of, like, you'll find out a lot of profiles from back in the day about her are mostly other people in her life talking about her. And then we get that one rare interview where she's like, I'm just like Rapunzel.
Is there a biography of her? I feel like I heard about this recently.
Yes, but Nina Meyer wrote it.
No! Is that...
Yeah. He's not a bad guy. He really just tried to stay as faithful to her voice as he could for as long as he could. The last book just came out. There will be no more BC Andrew books after Mother of God. What is this one is called? Also, as we are talking about her, she will probably appear in my bedroom as she does every single time I read about her. She's one of those ghosts where she's like super excited that you're talking about her.
Well, damn. Niedermeyer is the one sort of hand chosen by her estate, blessed. Yes.
They tested a bunch of different. Basically, her estate was worth so much that they were like, "Oh, we can't stop." Like the thought. What they could have done is license every book, but they didn't do that. Was not a thought, I guess, back in the day. Like was to sign IP away, which they should have done because there were so many studios that wanted to do stuff. And so instead they were like, we're just going to get this man who's wrote a few books to like do this. The last one is called Bird Lane Island, which is like, that'll be like the last one. He mimicked her style the best, but also he was very committed to going through her list of ideas because she wrote the first Dark Angel book and then... Did she write Dawn or did she only write part of Dawn?
Because but was his biography of her, was there an intent to sort of protect any mother's malicious actions?
I don't know. I'm trying to remember, like, oh my God, Andrew Niedermeyer's 85 now.
Oh, honey.
Jesus, wow. Effing Christ, dude. Maybe it wasn't a full biography. Maybe it was, yeah, because I read a thing that he had written about her, but maybe it wasn't like a full.
Let me look.
Because I know he wrote a fucking thing.
Oh, yeah. The Woman Behind the Attic. Yes, by Andrew Niederman.
Okay, yeah. It came out 2022. I'm like, this has really mixed reviews. And I think I had gotten it when I still had a Kindle, like, years ago. Some of the reviews are like, okay. Like, there's some secrets. Like, we do get to hear about how she doesn't really, like, love, like, her mother that much. And also, like... She was, like, unable to convince doctors, like, of, like, the severity of her injuries. Like, she was in a lot of pain, and they were like, you're fine. Not much has changed in that fucking regard. But the book has, like, 3 stars on Goodreads. Then again, so does mine, I think, probably. My first one or does. So, like, whatever. A lot of the reviews are like, I'm giving it 2 stars because it's not long enough. Like, I am so sorry, Anne. Like, I made a longer fucking book of poetry. Well, my book is, like, 4 out of 5 or something. Yeah, it's like, so I'm so fucking sorry. But then again, all of BC Andrew's books are all at 3 stars also, like, which is, like, really funny.
Yeah, that might be because they're so divisive. I mean, I know when it first came out, the Washington Post described it as swill and, quote, perhaps the worst book I've ever read. But then again, like, they're not going to be these incredible bestsellers. Like, even the, you know, there is something successful in reaching, there's something in that book is working if it reaches those heights. You know, I'm not at all into the Court of X and Y fantasy series, but there is something there that keeps people reading, you know? Yeah. There's something has been done successfully within that.
So what's funny is, like, a lot of these reviews are like, this is a cash grab, there's just not much here, and I'm like, that is what I remember, that it's just like letters that she wrote to her family.
Oh.
He does not talk about being her ghostwriter at all.
Oh no.
And also, like, he really, like, I don't know, it's funny that is reflected here in this review. Hi, Lois. Thank you for this. He thinks it's very sexist and ableist, the way he talks about her. And I didn't get through the whole thing because I didn't like the way it was written. I was like, how are you better at writing as her than you are writing about her? That's very interesting. But there was a lot of like, even like when she, back then, like she's, how could this innocent woman write these like salacious books? And apparently that is definitely how that comes. Like he was very much like this innocent woman, like bro, like come on, guy.
Oh,
like,
interesting. I wonder at that point how much ownership he feels over the stories. In his success or the success of the IP, does he start to take ownership of this is my thing versus this is her original thing? I don't know. I'm fully putting that on there with knowing absolutely nothing.
Good news. My book has 4.08 stars out of 5. But
hell yeah. It's more than Flowers in the Attic. That's huge.
Well, he wrote the stage play that came out in 2014. So I definitely think it is so interesting to have ownership over the work, but distance himself from her.
Yeah.
I think people were expecting a very intimate biography.
Yeah.
He never knew her.
Okay. I wasn't sure about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
He never knew her. He had her big fucking file of like ideas and stuff, but he never knew her. Yeah, like all the different women who have been through God knows what in all of the different books. Like, I mean, it's just like he knows them more than he ever like knew. Like Dawn ended up being one of the most famous V.C. Andrew novels because like she didn't write. Let's find out for a second.
Yeah, but that is interesting that there feels like some sort of parallel between Niedermeyer, yeah, taking over and this initial idea with her writing it without her first name of people assuming that it was a man.
Dark Angel is her last book. I don't have Fallen Hearts, but the half of that is written by Andrews and he finished it. And then he wrote Gates of Paradise in its entirety. Dawn came out in 1990 and that ended up being super popular. Mm. So you'll find that a lot of later V.C. Andrews books say the author of Flowers in the Attic and Dawn. People really, really liked those books and still thought it was her because that was the whole point. But during the time we had the Dawn series and like the blah blah blah, like her in this like mansion and like I'm trying to remember what the fuck happened. She's 14 and like some terrible shit happens. There's like that's every book.
Okay, so
I forget exactly what happens, but it was at the same time that R.L. Stine was putting out his Fear Street books, and so you had just like, and those had some creepy ass covers, and so it was such a time for like bad things happening to teenagers. But he definitely was very, very insanely motherfuckingly proud of that particular series. Lifetime produced the rest of it as a movie. Breck Basinger, who is a wonderful actor, is so fun to fucking watch, plays Dawn, and Fran Drescher's in it, and Jesse Metcalf, and Joey McIntyre, and everyone who's ever needed a check in the year of the Lord, like, is in it. Those were big in the 90s, and, like, he was very proud of those. And
is Dawn related to any of her other series, or it's a standalone, or initially a standalone?
Yes, okay. It's a standalone. They revisited, sweet, everything is its own, like, the Gemini series, the Shadow series, but, like, eventually, we got a sweet Audrina motherfucking, like, oh, we did get a, like, Christopher's Diary, Secrets of Foxworth.
Right.
But then we got, like, where is the White Fern bullshit? No one asked for a prequel. We got a prequel to Flowers in the Attic. Beneath the Attic, Out of the Attic. Those are fine. That's about Corinne and, like, her marriage.
Right.
Those are fine. I honestly, like, if you get through to, like, the end of the Flowers in the Attic series and you're like, wait a minute, I want more. Like, I would totally pick those up because they're very quick reads. But where's the fucking White Fern, sweet fucking Audrina thing? Oh, yeah, the Castile series also, like, is, yeah, Heaven and Dark Angel. I really like those books, mainly because the girl's name is Heaven, and, like, they live in West Virginia, and I lived there for 5 years, so I didn't read those until I lived there. And I was just like, wait, no, this is exactly how it is. It is so fucking bleak and terrible here. Beautiful, so bleak and terrible.
And we've talked about the salaciousness of it, of the sort of, there's something kind of whispered and it's shared between people. What do you think makes not only the first book but the whole series so sticky? What makes it keep being bestsellers even if it's not sold on you know the merit of the book but the merit of the series, and sticky for you that you want to keep coming back to it?
In the sequel to Flowers in the Attic, Petals in the Wind, they find the mom. And they, like, Kathy, like, I'm, wait, right, let me make sure I'm saying that it is in this book specifically. Because wait, because if it's not this one, then it might be the third one. Oh, I lied. Kathy ends up actually like trying to be a ballerina, basically.
Oh, okay.
And then that all fucking ends up sucking. So I misspoke. But Carrie does die. So whatever. But also, if there are so many plots that end up being so similar in the other series that go on, that, like, it starts to blend if you start reading a lot of them. So they find the mom in the second book, and she, like, tars and feathers her mom and cuts her hair off. And wow. Is just, like, not happy after. Like, and
Kathy
the mom
does that to Corinne. Okay.
Yes. And Corinne just sits there and kind of just lets it happen.
Wow.
Also, like, Kathy ends up marrying this abusive man, and obviously Chris is not happy about that. And another thing happens in that book that I'm pretty sure the husband, like breaks her toes so she can't dance.
It feels right, yeah.
Yeah. And which, like, everything just sets up for, like, Kathy and Chris to just be together.
Mm-hmm.
But also, she miscarried the incest baby. Everything's fine. But Carrie does die. But I'm trying to remember how... Because, like, if you're asking what kept me going, this shit, like,
yeah.
every terrible thing that ends up happening, like, oh, yeah, because Carrie gets ill and she dies, I guess. Is that what happens? Yeah, that is what happens. Kathy decides to, like, take revenge after Carrie dies because, like.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. So, but the most fucked up thing ever, and I hate it and it bothers me, is, like, she poisons herself with the same arsenic. Because she's like, it's effective, so I might as well do that.
Kathy does? Or Carrie? That's fascinating. Well, I'm going to read them. Wow, that's fascinating. I didn't really care for Carrie, but I think that's partly just like, in the beginning, she's annoying. She yells. And it's also like, she's five. You know, she's five in horrific circumstances.
What's crazy about the third book is that they are narrated by Kathy's kids. The one kid that she has with the first husband and then the kid that she has with Chris.
Okay.
Wait. Interesting. Yeah, wait, hold on. Then who the fuck was Paul? Hold on. Who the fuck was Paul? Let me look. Who the fuck was Paul again? So Paul takes care of them, and then Kathy falls in love with Paul, and then...
Oh, is Paul the new husband?
Corinne's... No.
Okay.
Paul ends up being, like, a widower. Like, so basically, in some, like, kind of, like, racially problematic thing, they are, like, rescued by, like, a mute African-American woman named Henrietta.
Okay.
Which is kind of like, okay.
The mute thing really tells you something.
Yes. And that's and that's how they meet this widower doctor guy named Paul. And like, he's weird. He insists that she didn't have a miscarriage and all this shit and like real weird stuff. But he's kind of like their adoptive like father that she falls in love with. But then she ends up marrying the other like asshole dancer guy.
Okay.
But wait, who is the other fucking... Hold on. This is what bothers me. It's like the kids are half fucking something. Right. Okay. So Kathy's second son is fathered by Kathy's stepfather. Bart.
That's what his name is. Yes.
His name is Bart Jr. And I forget how that happens. How does that happen?
Although the seeds of that are planted in this book, because at one point Kathy sneaks out of the attic and sees Bart like asleep and kisses him. Mm-hmm. And that plants this idea, I think, in Bart that something is amiss here. They have both noticed that money is going out of their pockets and disappearing, and it's Christopher. That was such an interesting setup.
Basically, like, her and Bart just end up fucking kikiing. It's all under the guise of, like, revenge.
Yeah.
But then Bart ends up, like, falling in love with Kathy, and he's like, oh, no, should I stay with your mother who's terrible? I don't really know. But then, like, it's great because, like, she fucking sets Foxworth Hall on fire. And I think that's how he dies. Yes. And then Corinne gets committed to a mental institution. And then the tarring feathering thing, I think, happens also in the book. Okay.
Wow. Yeah. And of course, that parallels that the grandmother puts tar in Kathy's hair. And
yes.
There's a lot of time, not unjustly, spent on that process.
It's so funny how, like, I, like, reread as much as I could. And then the rest of the books, I just kind of, like, skimmed through. Because I was like, I'm not going to need to know all of this.
No. But I think that's a fair point of like the reason that they stick is that there is so much happens even within this. I mean, you said it was a stage play. That's perfect. This was designed to be a stage play, all happening, of course, in this one attic. I want to just mention there's this incredible moment where the reason why Kathy's mom has to go back to the grandfather is because she did nothing. She was a housewife. And the novel, I think, starts in the 50s. I spent so much time trying to track down all of the dates of when this could have happened. I was also going through this being like, why was dad not in the war? Why was dad not
Why was
drafted?
dad not in the war?
Why was dad not in World War II? And why doesn't that come into things? But there's a moment where the mother, Corinne, is talking about her relationship with her father, that he wanted her to be his possession, his like art object to be seen and observed. And there's a moment where the grandmother is like, absolutely never rely on men. Christopher does something for her. And she's like, absolutely never let that happen. And Kathy reiterates it later at some point of like, I never want to do this. I never want to be my mom. I never want to have this reliance on other people. And something I really, really wish that we got more information on the grandmother. She is such a fascinating character. We see her as like so stark. She's all in black. She has such a vivid vision, and then they watch this Christmas party occur, and she is like has jewels up to her chin, and she's in this like red dress or something. And there's just, I don't know that I necessarily want a book from Corinne's childhood, but I have so many questions about it. I wonder if her father is obviously physically and mentally abusive. I wonder if he's sexually abusive. I have so many questions.
The prequels definitely answer all of that. I just don't remember them being like exciting later. I just kind of remember them being like, okay, yeah, like okay. So it is the grandmother that she ends up tarring, like cutting her hair with, which means I don't remember what the fuck happened to the mom. But Kathy gets all of her revenge. The only thing is like she's not happy about any of it. Like she sets the fire and the grandma dies, and then Corinne gets like committed to mental, and then like she so Kathy gets all of her revenge. No one else is like Christopher is not really concerned with revenge. Like he just wants to be with Kathy. But like all I remember is being a kid and and then reading that scene, and I don't know which book it is in because like the Google AI thing sucks ass. But it just bothered me so much as a kid. I was just like, why isn't she happy? I don't get it.
Has your perspective on that changed in later readings of it as you get older?
As an adult, I'm like, oh. But even so, I'm such a vengeful bitch that I feel like I would be fine. Maybe like I'd have to be like, I'm a baddie with two therapists, and I feel like I'd have to be like, so guys, how come I did this thing but I don't feel better about it? So I feel like I get it like now. Garden of Shadows is about the grandmother, the last book in the. We don't learn about Corinne, but we learn about like the grandmother for some fucking reason. But I guess Virginia was not concerned about Corinne. Like she just wasn't like that interested. And I'm just like, okay, fair. But the third book is narrated by the two half brothers, which is interesting. Kathy's son from the asshole guy. I was so happy that guy kills himself. I was like, yeah. Like I remember being 11 and being like, yeah. And then Bart Jr. and Dory, who are like half brothers, and they don't know that their parents are like siblings. It becomes like a whole reveal to them.
But it's interesting that, or I think perhaps a possible source of resonance is that Kathy has such a strict sense of justice, which I think, sort of black and white binary thinking is typical to kids, especially when the world to you does not have as much nuance because you're learning about it. But I think also, like, I can hear that in how you read it as a child.
Yes.
Which is so fascinating. Yeah, I think Kathy is such a relatable character. It's back in that Gillian Flynn quote.
I remember what happens to Corinne now. Okay. In If There Be Thorns, suddenly this woman starts being like, hello, Bart and Jory, I'm your grandmother. And then they find out that this terrifying ass woman is actually like, and so basically, once like Bart finds out, he goes fucking ape shit. And that's funny
Bart
because,
the child?
yes, Bart Jr. goes insane. And I forget, like, it's real bad. Like, and it's funny because the back of the book says, a transformation that led him to shocking acts of violence, self-destruction, and perversity. And it's true, it's bad. There's like a part in this book where like Christopher has to like discipline them or whatever. And
Oh.
he like spanks Bart Jr. And Christopher like feels bad. And he's like, does that hurt? And I'm pretty sure Bart says like, no, to hurt me, you'd have to break my bones. Some shit like that. And I think I remember being like, oh no. So crazy
Yeah.
apple, crazy tree. What's really fucked up is because they're not great at parenting, wouldn't you know? To discipline them, she sends them into the attic.
No!
And it's just kind of like, we haven't learned anything.
Well, isn't that a detail that the grandmother was also punished by her parents by being locked, I don't know, in an attic, but in a room? Gosh.
As a kid, I kind of just like did not care enough about Garden of Shadows. I like wanted to. I don't remember how Seeds of Yesterday ends either, which is really fucking funny to me because, oh, I have it here. This is the last one. Basically everything like bad that could ever happen, happens basically. I mean, like Bart ends up being, her kid ends up being like the villain of the rest of the series.
Oh.
Because once he finds everything out, he's not this. I don't blame him. The fuck?
Yeah.
Like, I don't blame him. Yeah, everything ends. When I said it ends fine, it ends as fine as it could.
Yeah, people with these circumstances could possibly.
It ends on the it's never too late. And I fucking remember now. And that's so sad. It feels like, I remember some criticism being like, well, none of the rest of the series is realistic. And I was like, well, first of all, okay. But also, like, I think that her having a kid who, with her evil stepfather and the kid being evil is the most logical, and becoming more evil after he finds out how his parents are actually related.
Yeah.
Because they were like, oh, Christopher was Paul's brother. And so after Paul died, I just remarried Christopher because I was so, Paul's the doctor who like saved them or whatever.
Right.
Yeah, like, and I was so sad when like he died and then Bart died. So I just married Christopher and they were like, okay. And it turns out everyone just has their fucking personal diaries and files just laying around in the 80s and the 70s.
Yeah. So Christopher's diary, is that, I assumed it was like a Midnight Sun situation of like he was also keeping a diary during. Yeah, that seems doubtful to me. Again, because you're in one room forever. Well, you gotta sell the books, I guess.
It gives us the rape scene from his perspective.
Oh, we didn't need that.
Nope, we did not. We did not. Very much a Midnight Sun situation. No one asked for it. No one needed it. No one was like, hell yeah, like this is totally, we asked for this. What's really funny is some of the books, like I just like found, what's really funny is there's a teaching guide in the back of this PDF.
No.
And it's like, what transformation does Kathy undergo in her interaction with her grandmother? Answer: initially seeking revenge, Kathy confronts her grandmother with the intention to inflict psychological pain. However, as she observes her grandmother's frailty and vulnerability, she experiences a conflict between her desire for revenge and the recognition of her grandmother's mortality, leading to a moment of empathy. And I was 12 being like, well, that's stupid. That's yeah. Real stupid.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously reading this for the first time in my late 20s, because this was my first time reading the book, the fact that Kathy is not satisfied by that revenge, to me, makes sense, because ultimately, you can never get those 3 years back. You know, you can never get, once your childhood ends, there is no, and they're very explicit, she's very explicit about, like, when I hopped on that train, which is the train to the Foxworth house that she's mm-hmm. trapped in, my childhood ended. And when your childhood ends, you can never really go back to it. And that's a big sort of theme within the book. It's so difficult because like that question of realism is like, there is realism within these unrealistic circumstances. That's like, that's good fiction, is finding the grain of humanity in these crazy things. That's why a lot of Stephen King works. It's because you put realistic characters in hyper unreal situations.
It's realistic characters and it's a high concept, everything else.
Yes.
And that's why they're so hard to adapt with King, and why so many things become camp.
Yeah.
Because the blend just does not work. I feel like Andy Muschietti's It universe really like finds, especially Derry, like it's like, here are all the things that Pennywise can turn into, but you're still terrified and you still want to hold all these children. I'm like, and good. But then we had like, what, Trucks, the movie about the killer trucks, and like all of that was a lot of scary driving for an hour and a half. So you win some, you lose some. When I was doing EMDR therapy, I was in West Virginia. I was sitting in like the waiting room with someone who was literally a POW, and he loves Flowers in the Attic because he says he finds it really, he was like, I just find it really fucking relatable. And I was just like, that makes sense. But yeah. He was like, there's no feeling like every day is the same. He was like, you'll never get past that. So like, either you go to therapy and try really hard, or you just slowly descend into madness, as everyone is by the end of the fucking series. But they tried. I will say, like, Kathy and Christopher tried really, really hard. Kathy did like ballet, but then she married that abusive guy who broke her fucking feet. Like she tried, and they tried to raise the kids normally. Everyone tried. And but of course, like, one of the kids had to be demon. God, I forgot about that. I forgot that he's like so creepy and stuff. And yeah. I'm just like, man, like, can everyone have like one good day?
Oh, well, and then it gets back to this idea of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, grandmother thinks that Chris and Kathy are demon spawn, and then they procreate and they have something pretty close to demon spawn. If they had not been put in those circumstances, that might not have happened. Oh, it's all brutal. Which I think is probably why it's so successful, is delving into the worst of it. I assume the answer is yes. Have you continued to revisit and reread this series throughout your life?
Throughout my life, yes. Within like the last few years, no. Well, so during 2020, I reread the entire series. And right. That was like the first time I read like Dark Angel and like Heaven and stuff too. And I was like so sad that she died right at, because she did not want to do chemo. She was like, I had to keep writing. I like read the first like two, and I was like, I'm not going to keep fucking reading. But I have read some of the Nina Meyer books, and I'm just like, but I will revisit this series because I feel like every decade of my life, it's just different.
Say more, please. Say so much more.
Well, in middle school, it was like, ooh, and everyone thinks it's weird that I'm reading this. We're all passing it around, like, each other, borrow it. And it's like, ooh. And then in high school, your English teacher is like, well, we can actually talk about this for a second. And you're like, oh, fuck, really? Because I was in advanced English class. So we were more mature in those classes. And it being like, well, actually, like, here's the harsh reality of, like, abuse and shit. And then you're like, oh, okay. And then you're in college, and then you get back to being like, heh, 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 but also, oh, and so, and then I'm in my 30s, and now it's a lot of like, I really hated, My Favorite Murder had an episode where they just talked about how Flowers in the Attic and My Sweet Adrian are the worst books they've like ever read in their entire life. And I'm like, you guys like spent like 3 years reading off of a Wikipedia page. Like, you can't say anything. It bothered me so much. Which made me go back and read My Sweet Adriana, because I was like, there's no way. And I can understand now at this age, objectively, why someone would pick up one of these books and think this stuff. But it's like, either you get it or you don't get it. It's so hyper-specific. I feel like you could say the same thing about picking up a Christopher Pike book, though, too.
Yeah.
Like, or like an R.L. Stein, the ones that are like written for like teenagers. They all kind of have, I will also say too, Christopher Pike and R.L. Stein and Beth Andrews all have a similar style.
I would say
that Beth Andrews is the most vivid and like is more of a painter than those two are. Like, I feel like no one really writes like her, but there's still that whole like, you open the book and the pages are kind of yellow and everything is sinister. And there are elements of the Fear Street books that remind me so much of the V.C. Andrews books. And so if I ever got to interview R.L. Stein, I would be like, so how much of this shit did you read?
Right.
There's actually a very specific Fear Street book. These three sisters, like, one of them gets on a horse and like breaks her neck, basically, and becomes this child vegetative like thing, and like in like a popular 16-year-old girl's body. It's very sad. And like, then suddenly people keep getting murdered, and like, it's like, oh, it's a woman with red hair. Like, I'm like, oh, but the sister who's like disabled, like, has red hair. People are like, wait, there's no way she's capable of like murder. Right. That doesn't make sense. It ends up being the youngest sister like avenging her. And the way she kills herself at the end after she's found out, and she like, as she's going under the ice, she's like, I did it for you, Rachel. And it bothered me almost as much as like reading these books have bothered me.
Wow. I've only read one Fear Street book, and it was all about revenge also. Interesting.
The one about the girl who like gets murdered on a ski trip with her boyfriend and then takes over some bitch's body, and then at the end her fuck ass like corpse like shows up with her face like what, I don't know what it is about women getting revenge, but like,
well, oh,
they don't do it like they used to. I think that everyone who has only read Flowers in the Attic should invest and just read the rest of the books, or you can do what a lot of people did and just like read Flowers in the Attic and then read My Sweet Audrina. I think that the order should be Flowers in the Attic, and then you read My Sweet Audrina, and then you read the rest of the Dollhanger series, and then you read the first two books in the Heaven series, and then you just stop there.
Interesting.
Some of the Nina Meyer books are fine, like the Dawn series in the 90s is actually pretty good, because I think it sounds the most like her, and it feels most like Flowers in the Attic than the rest of everything that he's written does, honestly, in my opinion. So if you're really feeling like you need to read about something else bad happening to a young woman in a mansion or some shit, like Dawn is there. But I also recommend, there's not a lot of information about BC Andrews online, but I really recommend just like reading as much as you like possibly can, because like she was so interesting. And so the last thing I will share is, so I grew up in South Florida, we were middle class, so what do you go to Disney World or Universal for vacations. There was a Perkins location, which I think is still there, and they used to have one of those free libraries in the Perkins. Every time we would go back for at least 3 years, there was always B.C. Andrews novels there. And that's when I started learning. I feel like I had to have been still in middle school learning about which ones were like written by her and which ones weren't. So a lot of these are from the fucking Perkins in Orlando. And I don't know who, but I remember sitting in the car. We're getting close to our Disney hotel, and I'm on my phone and I'm reading about her. And it's her fan page that originally was like hosted by like one of those sites where it was like black with green text on them, like
Matrix
websites, like ever, like Angel Fire, but even before that. And I remember like reading it and then like turning to my left and seeing her face like in the window, the car window, like smiling at me. So there are certain people you read about that like just appear, and I mean, I'm maybe a little bit more clairvoyant than others, I guess, but like my only thing is, if you read about her in the dark and you hear footsteps in the hallway, it's fine.
It's
actually fine. Yeah.
You can read dark things and not be malicious.
You can be visited by spirits and they're just kind of chilling.
And I really, really, I wish people knew that writing was a late in life thing to her. I think that is special. And I know a lot of people take hope and comfort in people who come to one of their callings, at least later on in life. I think that's quite nice. And then she was like immediately so successful.
It reminds me of a lot of like, even like actors right now who are having like a renaissance. Like, I think Matthew Lillard and like Juan Goggins are both 50, and they're like the most booked and busy they've ever been in their entire lives. And I'm just kind of like, hell yeah. It's funny because you don't think back in the day either that a woman late in her life could have a career like that. But also, it just also unfortunately has to do with the fact that they took her fucking name off of everything.
Yeah.
And which she was annoyed about and didn't fucking understand. But J.K. Rowling's people were inspired by the B.C. Andrews thing.
I didn't know that, but makes complete sense. And so that thing was still happening 20 years later in the 90s and into the aughts. Yeah.
And there are still a lot of books that were, I remember being popular. Like, it's funny, like, do I remember the 90s? Yes. but like books that I didn't find out until later were written by women, but like had like the manliest man names ever. So I think that's really fucking interesting. I remember like reading that, like, she was not happy. Like, she was like, what is V? What the fuck? And I was like, your middle name. She was like, why isn't it? Why isn't it CV? She was like really fucking annoyed by that. But then it became like her whole brand and her whole fucking thing. So it's just kind of like, And it sucks that she was not around for like the rest of it.
Yeah. Because so within that short amount of time, so prolific. I mean, one a year. Incredible. But I guess that brings me to my final question. Mm-hmm. Would you consider this required reading?
Yes. I feel like required reading is like subjective.
Absolutely.
If I could have assigned this, I absolutely would have. I just would have had to find a literary reason for it in the curriculum, and I just could not. But I definitely feel like if you like Stephen King books, you have to read B.C. Andrews. And especially if you read On Writing and you saw his little shitty comment about it, you have to read it. Love that man, but damn, that was so petty. Even if you've read Fear Street, if you've read like anything that looks old that like has one of those like illustrated covers from like the late 80s, late 90s, those were all inspired by E.C. Andrews.
Mm.
So any horror book that you like that came out like is probably like directly influenced. So in some way. Yeah. So like you should probably just go read it.
Yeah, I think bare minimum, you should hear what all the fuss is about with this book, and mm-hmm. you will be very well rewarded with what you end up consuming. You finish it and you're like, I gotta get the next one. I gotta know what happens.
But you have to, if you're gonna read it, I don't recommend like going to Barnes & Noble and getting like the new versions of it. If you can go to an old ass bookstore, like if you can go to thriftbooks.com and get it for like $3.
And
like,
I will. And I will.
The Yellow Pages, this version, the 80s tie-in edition, like also has so many errors in here too, which I think is so fun. There are quotes where there should not be open quotes, like just like little things like missing, and like I don't know, I love that for some reason, but also nothing beats the smell of an old book.
Correct. Oh, tarot
what
card.
What is this? Okay, well we just found something in Lauren's edition of this, because I usually read the other one that
yeah.
has that, like, where is that though? Oh, it's on the
floor. Like with the more classic, yeah, sort of like the red and black with the,
yeah, yes.
This is what I'm going to use for the cover art for this episode.
The
yeah.
original cover, like, is that, but it opens to the creepy, like it actually
yeah.
opens. Yeah.
Ooh.
What is this?
Is that a tarot card?
I'm going to have to. Okay. I just got weird, insane chills.
Yeah.
This feeling that's been happening for a week. Like, and so. Oh, but it's copyrighted 2009, so it just looks old, but it's not old. What does it mean? I'm going to have to Google search this. Okay, so guess what, guys? If you thrift something off of, like, thriftbooks.com or out of a fucking, like, Perkins, like, free library, stuff will just appear inside, I guess.
I love doing that. Because I got this from a little free library, first off. Shout out.
Oh, cool.
And when I give things back to little free libraries, I'm going to keep this one. I do like to put random tarot cards in them, because tarot cards don't do anything for me. I don't really know why I have a deck, but I am like, this is going to either make someone chuckle or freak someone out. And that's very satisfying to me.
You know what's crazy is this version of Dark Angel that I thrifted has, like, it looks like blood spatter.
Yeah.
And that's why this was like heavily discounted. And I was like, you know what? I have to get this actually.
Yeah.
But that's really funny. Like putting a tarot card in a book. I feel like you know that someone needed confirmation, like angel numbers type shit.
Yes.
And they opened the book and they were like, I'm gonna sell my house.
Exactly.
So you might have ruined someone's life kind of a little bit, but that's okay.
I hope I have that power.
You know what? I hope you do too. I wanna know what the fuck this is. Oh my god, that's so fucked up.
What is it?
It's the Two of Cups. I'll tell you why that's fucked up after we get off this episode.
Okay, sounds good.
Oh my god, okay.
Well, is there, because I want to know, is there anything you'd like to plug now that we're here at the end?
Oh my god, see, I signed my contract for my new book, but I can't promote it yet.
Okay, well, your existing book, was it Sexy Sad Catholic?
You can get Sad Sexy Catholic pretty much, like, you can order it through if you want to support Jeff Bezos, you can get through Amazon, or you can get it through Barnes & Noble, or you can, like, it's in the most random bookstores, it's at Shakespeare & Company in fucking Paris.
Cute.
But then it's also at Paper Moon in Troy. Wherever books are sold randomly, my book might be there. I have so many interviews and things going up on gamesradar.com. If you like movies and you like to hear people who make movies talk about movies, my favorite thing that I have put up recently is an interview with David Dismalchin, who is the actor that is in every single thing we've ever seen, but I'm always like, oh, it's that guy, who's also just now having kind of a big career renaissance as well. We just talked about, like, what DC, like, villains he wants to play in.
Ooh,
shit.
Nice.
And then I have, like, a plethora of also a bunch of insane interviews coming out. So read my things, because it will make my editors happy.
Yay! Well, thank you so much. I can't wait to hear what this is. Okay, I'm going to stop the recording.
This is so fucked up.